This is Daniela. To come here. Let me just say some things about the schedule and what's going to happen, what we're going to do this week. So we have a lot of talks, but we also left a lot of room for people to get to know each other. A large part of the idea of this conference is for you all who have been invited in the different fields to get to know each other, the people within your field who you may not know, but also the people in other fields. A large part of the idea is that we want to have a conference. This perimeter, as I'll discuss in a minute, is very oriented towards empowering younger researchers and people, especially at the postdoctoral level. And so a large part of the idea of this conference is to give you a chance to get to know each other and each other's work. Hopefully that's interesting. And it's also another goal of our institute, which is to try to bring the diverse fields of theoretical physics together. We used to call this interdisciplinary. That is, that it's very, very important to do something to combat the extreme specialization and encourage interdisciplinary activities. But recently in discussion, somebody pointed out that we're actually all part of the same discipline. So it's a little bit silly to be talking about interdisciplinary when it's within the narrow range of people that might range from, you know, early universe cosmology to string theory to quantum information to quantum gravity. Because this is really just theoretical physics, and we all have the same goal, which is to discover what the laws of nature are and to understand them better. So rather than promoting interdisciplinarity, we're promoting disciplinarity. in the discipline. So anyway, those are two goals which are important when Perimeter was founded, which is now this is now the eighth year, which is pretty remarkable. We started in, some of you have a chance to see it, in a small red brick building over there, red stone building over there on King Street, with three faculty and four postdocs in the fall of 2001, in September of 2001. And now we're roughly 10 or 11 faculty on the way to about on the way to about 25, and something like 36 postdocs on the way to, we're not really sure, but maybe 45, 50. So we've grown quite a bit. At the moment, there are about 80 scientists who are in this building at least part-time. In addition to the faculty and postdocs, we have people, and this is to help you out with some of the vocabulary. We have people who are called associates, which means that they're faculty based both at a university somewhere else and a university and ourselves. We have, and we have at the moment about 9 of those. We have people called affiliates, which of which there are, I think, here's Jimmy, this is our host, our chair, Jimmy Ryan. I just took over, but I'll see it to you anyway.
It was my fault, sorry.
Affiliates are people who are doing research in one of our fields, or faculty members in one of our fields, somewhere at a Canadian university, who have some rights to visit here at some time. We also have some senior researchers who are people who have distinguished people who have retired, and we didn't plan for this, but they just kind of showed up. and we embraced them, who have retired from different places and decided to retire here and spend all or part of their time here. And we have some unplanned ones, for example, Borkane, people know Borkane, Borkane Drow. Just kind of drops by, but he refuses to tell us when he's coming. He doesn't want to be scheduled. So we have And we also have students in the building. We are not a degree granting institution, but we have an arrangement with several universities, principally the University of Waterloo, so that faculty here can advise or supervise PhD students. And so there are about 25 PhD students in the building in all the different fields. And there's a handful of undergraduates as well doing research. So these are all, so this is the full spectrum of people you'll meet, from our senior researchers down to undergraduate students. We also run programs for high school students, but I don't think there are any I know of in the building. We do that during the summer. High school students and high school teachers from around the world. So we left a lot of room in the schedule. As you saw this morning, you were probably waiting, you know, why don't we start, given that you're jet lagged and woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning, why don't we start the meeting at 7 in the morning? So we left time for you all to hang out and get to know each other. You should also very much take advantage of the possibility of meeting faculty and postdocs and visitors and everybody else who's in the building. For example, this is Chris Fuchs, who's a very charming person to meet, if you don't know him. And this is Raz Bhatt. He's just coming in. Here's the idea of the schedule, and then I'll turn things over to Jimmy. We have done a little grouping in fields, but mostly we've mixed people up. So there's some pairings, but mostly we've mixed up all the fields to give everybody a chance to hear talks in all the fields. What we have done is proceeded the talks by you, the invitees, in each field with an introductory talk in each field, so that people who are new to, for example, quantum gravity are about to have a chance to hear first an introductory talk in quantum gravity before hearing the more specialized talks. And we do this in each of the fields so that everybody can have a chance for an introduction. The atmosphere here, people come from a lot of different places. This is a very North American loose atmosphere. We like questions, we like interruptions. The chairs will have a hard job to keep everybody to time, and I hope that they will. But we like to have a lively atmosphere. So if you have questions, unless there have been so many questions that the speaker says no more, come out with them. We have, at the end of today, a reception and then a dinner for everybody. At the dinner, we don't do this all the time, but we have a full-service restaurant there, so we sometimes can come up with a nice dinner. And you don't have to dress, it's not formal, but there will be name places. We want everybody to mix up at the dinner. And also, a lot of our faculty or postdocs will be at the reception dinner as well. Wednesday night is postdoc night in Waterloo. That means that there's some postdocs who know where to hang out here who are going to be leading delegations to go hang out. And there is more to life than the Jane Bond, if you've been here before. But you might make a stop at the Jane Bond. Thursday, there is, for those who are interested, there is available at the end of the morning. Thursday starts a little early because of this. Actually, it doesn't, but it ends a little early. There is a tour of IQC, which is the Institute for Quantum Computing, which is a sister institute to ours at the University of Waterloo, in which they do partly theoretical but mostly experimental quantum information theory. And they have a program to build a quantum computer. So if you're interested, I actually don't know who you tell, we'll try to find out, but if you're interested, there's going to be transportation over at 11:30 Thursday morning, and everybody, we have room for everybody as well to come over. And You get to see, you do not get to see the subphonic computer in the sub-basement, but we're still working on that, but there is, I think, a 14-bit quantum computer, maybe I'm exactly, maybe it's 12-bit quantum computer, 12 qubits, so like a, okay, very good, well, thank you very much, and Jimmy, take over.
Okay. So, the first session of the week is going to be quantum gravity, and it consists of three talks before lunch. First talk is given by Daniel Arizi, who's a senior postdoc here at VI. And so he will be giving the introduction to the concept of quantum gravity, and then we'll have a coffee break, and then we'll have two talks by young researchers after the coffee break. Daniel has asked me to notify him every 10 minutes, keep him on time, so if I'm frantically waving, it's not going to happen all the time.
Okay, so I'm going to give an introduction to quantum gravity. That's to be brief.
Daniela, is your microphone on?
No.
Yes, and by the way, every talk we give in this building is recorded unless and put on the internet unless you specifically tell somebody that you do not want your talk to be recorded.
I don't mind it being recorded. Can you hear me? All right? Okay, so the plan is to, first of all, tell you what the problem of quantum gravity is, why we think it's important, and also give you a flavor of why it is difficult. It's kind of a justification for why we haven't solved it yet. Give you a very brief sketch of what the possible strategies and of some current approaches. I'll be a little bit more specific, but again, I'll still be brief about one specific approach, which is group field theories. And then I'll discuss how we go back to physics as we know it from the more exotic quantum gravity scenarios. And so the aim is only to give a general overview and some motivation. Of course, some basic concepts of the various approaches and of the formalism being developed. Moreover, probably the main aim is to give a context for the more technical talks that will follow today and later in the week. So let me put forward some cautionary remarks. So there will be very few technical details. So the talk is mainly aimed at those not working quantum gravity, who are the majority here. There will be no real review of the results obtained in the different approaches and no history of the subject. There is a vast literature on that you can follow. And I will not be talking about strings, even though, of course, string theory is one of the approaches to quantum gravity, but simply because there will be another introduction to string theory later in the week. Okay, so what we know first about gravity? Let's start from what we know. We know that gravitational physics is well described by general relativity. Okay, that's a good starting point. We have tested very well in the solar system, in several astrophysical systems, pulsars, for example. It is very well tested on Earth. It is, in some sense, implicitly well tested at the particle physics scale, simply because we use the approximation in which gravity is kind of switched off. We have a Minkowski space, a flat Minkowski space, and everything seems to work. So in a sense, some of these assumptions are tested. And in a similar way, it is implicitly tested at cosmological states, scales, because we use it again in the classical approximation to describe the background over which quantum fields interact, even at the early universe. So overall, it's the basis for our current description of astrophysics and cosmology. So, okay, let's learn from there. What is the basic lesson from general relativity? Well, we've learned that gravitational physics is space-time geometry. This is a crucial point because it means the space-time itself is a physical system which interacts with other physical systems like matter fields. That's crucial because it tells us that try to obtain a better description of gravity means trying to understand better what space and time are. And again, the main lesson is that because space-time itself is a physical system which evolves, interacts, and so on, there is no background stage over which things happen. this could be a useful approximation, but it's not the the true story. And a deeper understanding of gravity, again, means a deeper understanding of space and time, and of their structure and dynamics. There are many things we don't know about gravity. So first of all, we know that generativity breaks down for very strong gravitational fields. You all know about space-time singularities, the main examples of which are the Big Bang singularity, the cosmological singularity, and the interior black holes. You know about that. We have no satisfactory description of the interaction of gravity with matter fields for the simple reason that all matter fields are described by quantum field theories. And so at the moment, we can only have a description of their interaction with gravity only in the approximation in which either we neglect the quantum properties of matter and we treat everything non-perturbatively and dynamically, but at the classical level, or if we fix gravity as a background and treat quantum fields on top of it. Okay, I would say there are some signs of this incompleteness in our lack of understanding of black hole physics, in particular black hole entropy and radiation. And there are things that we would like to understand better in the early universe cosmology as well. I add to this list also some pretty large-scale puzzles. So they go under the name of dark matter and dark energy, and so you will hear a lot about this in cosmology talks. And the situation, as far as I see as an outsider, is quite simple. So either we do not understand 95% of the content of the universe, but we stick to our understanding of gravity, or maybe we do not understand gravity even on large scales, so at a very large scale, galactic and cosmological. So let's keep that in mind, because in the second case, it means that we need to find a much better theory of space-time that explains also if there are modifications of generativity that can account for this sort of large-scale phenomena. And these modifications may well have a quantum origin. So it's not absolutely needed that the quantum effects of gravity are confined to small scales. Well, to me, a main motivation is that, well, we don't really like to be schizophrenic in our understanding of reality. And generativity and quantum mechanics have very different foundations. Although you will hear from the people in foundations of quantum mechanics that there's debate and much to understand about the foundations of quantum mechanics itself. Anyway, so it's not particularly nice to have to switch your point of view about what the nature of the world is and what the basic principles are according to whether you deal with the quantum field theories for matter or classical phenomena involving gravity. Okay, so the goal, bringing all this together, is that we want a new quantum theory of space, of the space-time microscopic structure and of its dynamics. And of course, this has to reproduce generativity and its description of geometry as a continuum field and of matter at the appropriate scale. And if there are modifications to it, then you should explain where this comes from. There are many approaches, and they basically go, I would say, in three main categories. One is, okay, we have a classical theory of gravity, quantize it. Just go and quantize it. Fine. And examples of this are, in a sense, the loop quantum gravity and some spinform models. These are the examples I will briefly mention. I mean, there are many others, of course. The idea, the second possibility is to first try to reduce gravity to the backbone, to what is really essential about geometry. And usually this takes some discrete form and gives you a discrete geometric theory, and then try to quantize this. And examples of this are, again, some spinform models, quantum energy calculus, causal sets, dynamical triangulations, and there is a plethora of approaches. A more radical possibility is to say, okay, we know what the endpoint is, but nobody tells me that gravity or space-time at small scales, well, should exist at all. We may start from something, from some physical system and a quantum model of some fundamental degrees of freedom. They're not geometric at all. They don't refer to space-time at all. We should just describe how a notion of space-time and of continuum geometry emerge out of this fundamental non-gravitational and non-geometric degrees of freedom. These perspectives are not incompatible with each other and not mutually exclusive. So why is it difficult? Well, I told you the main point. We cannot assume a background space-time because space-time is exactly what we want to describe. As simple as that. So in any approach, suppose that you retain geometry and space-time as a fundamental concept, still you would like to quantize it. That means that you want the idea of a quantum superposition of space-times and of geometry. But the quantum superposition of space-times is not a space-time. And if you don't even want to retain space-time and geometry as fundamental concepts, well, the situation in a sense is even worse. You have to formulate a theory in absence of any notion of space-time and geometry. Thank you, Jimmy. So this means that all the basic structure of usual quantum mechanical theories and quantum field theories are not available. There's no notion of locality. There's no notion of causality a priori. I mean, then, of course, the details depend on the approach. There's no notion of symmetry, of space-time symmetry. And one can go even further. There's no notion of, there may be no notion of space-time dimensionality to start with. All these have to be our features of the universe that we want to explain, not to assume. OK. And as I said, we don't know what is quantum mechanics in absence of a space-time. Still, say, OK, what about all the conceptual issues and so on? We have a theory, just quantize it. Well, GR is highly complicated. So even in the approaches that try to do that, so they're very minimalistic or in their way of tackling the problem, are only partially successful. And they do not tell us yet the complete story. And one example is loop quantum gravity. The other issue comes with diff invariance, which is another property of generativity, and which is strictly tied to background independence. In absence of, in presence of this symmetry, we cannot use any notion of point in space-time as an absolute quantity, as an absolute concept. And therefore, for example, typical observables in quantum field theory, like endpoint functions, are in general not well defined. You can go further and say, OK, there is a dynamical quantum geometry. There is very likely a dynamical quantum topology. And that is even more difficult to handle and to define, I mean, a superposition of topologies. And if you take the other point of view, that that the very notion of space-time, of continuum space-time and of geometry has to emerge from something else, well, it's hard to say from what. What are the basic degrees of freedom? What are the atoms of space, if you want to use this analogy? And then, OK, what type of space-time, what sort of signature, what type of geometry? I mean, Riemannian geometry is one example, but there are others. And we would like to be guided by phenomenology and by experiments. And it's hard to come up with the effects that have a clear quantum gravity signature so clear to guide us towards the construction of the theory. I'll say more about this later. Anyway, I'll give you now a very brief sketch of different approaches. So in the category of just quantized GR is at least in the original formulation of loop quantum gravity. So you start from a first order formulation of classical generativity, where the basic variables are a Lorentz connection and a triad in the canonical setting. And you do canonical quantization. So you define your phase space, your wave functions at the kinematical level, and then you start imposing the different constraints. Well, this is still in progress, especially for what concerns the dynamics and the Hamiltonian constraint, and it's very difficult. We learned many things, though. So we learned that the states of the gravitational field are given by spin networks, which are graphs labeled by group representations of the Lorentz group. So the geometry is fully encoded in combinatorics and algebra. And we have strong uniqueness results at this kinematical level. This representation of the basic variables, the representation that is used in loop quantum gravity, is unique. if you want to stick to diffeomorphism invariants. And the basic vacuum describes the empty space, where empty means that there's really nothing, there's no space. And the excitations of geometry are along the edges of the graphs, the spin networks, or the vertices of the graph. Moreover, we learned that geometric operators have discrete spectra. Okay, and already at this purely kinematical level, there are many interesting results, for example, concerning black hole entropy calculations, and you will hear a talk by Enrique about this later on. But, okay, we have difficulties with the canonical formulation of dynamics. Let's go to the covariant path integrals. So we can try to define the dynamics of loop quantum gravity in terms of some of the histories. What are the histories of spin networks? Well, spin foams. That means they are labeled by two complexes. They are identified by two complexes, so collections of vertices, edges, and faces. And there is a picture on the right side there. And what you need to do is to define from your preferred criteria and procedures a quantum amplitude for the sum over these histories. You assign a quantum amplitude to each of these histories, and you sum. And this amplitude is going to be a function of the combinatorics of the spin foam and of the representations that you attach to them. There are several models, and recently there's been a surge in activity in the field of spin foams because a new spin foam model has been proposed by several people: Engel, Pereira, Rovelli, Levine, Friedel, Krasnov, and you will hear much more about this in two talks later in the week by Engel and Pereira. Another possibility is to, as I said, you can try to quantize a classical theory, but not GR. I mean, some sort of reduced to the essential version of GR. So some discrete version of GR. And one example is so-called dynamical triangulations. So you take a continuum manifold, you triangulate it, so meaning you describe it, its topology by gluing together simplices. Think of triangles in 2D. And they're analog in higher dimensions. And because geometry at the end is about distances, you encode the geometry of this discrete space-time in the edge length. Then you discretize your classical action, the GR action, and you usually use, at least in this approach, what is called the Regge action for simplicial geometry, which is a function of the edge length and reduces to the Einstein-Hilbert action in some appropriately defined continuum limit. In this approach, you simplify the setting by fixing all the edge lengths equal so that you encode all the geometry only in the combinatorics of the triangulation. And then you define your quantum theory by a sum over all these triangulations, again, as a kind of a path integral, as a sum of histories. The aim is to define the correct continuum limit. And there are several indications that, there are good indications of a continuum limit in some very peculiar setting. Then, of course, there is probably a wider variety of approaches in the last, more radical perspective, which is the emergent gravity perspective. One example is quantum graffiti, and you can define it as a model of emergent locality. So you take a complete graph, and that's the one there on the left. Take n vertices, and you connect all of them pairwise. You label the edges of the graph by two parameters, one taking value only 0 and 1. And 0 means there's no edge. 1 means there is an edge. And m goes from minus 1 to 1. By assigning these labels, you have basically identified the subgraph. Then you want to define dynamics for this graph, and you specify Hamiltonian. And then you want to study in what is the choice of dynamics that basically minimizes the energy for regular graphs, so that you can see this reduction to a local regular graph as a dynamical process. There is a further possibility, and that's the one on the right, one example of a regular graph. And There's a further possibility is that, well, it's a necessity, I would say, that in this setting, not only you try to explain why some sort of a regular lattice that you interpret as discrete space emerges, but you want also to describe how gravitational and matter fields can be seen as emerging from the fundamental degrees of freedom you define on this regular graph. Another setting is that of condensed matter analog models. And, well, there are some suggestions that come from studies in condensed matter systems. You can imagine the space-time is a sort of a condensate or a fluid of some fundamental discrete constituents, and that the continuum that we see is some sort of hydrodynamic approximation for the dynamics of these discrete constituents. And generativity is the effective description of this hydrodynamic, in this hydrodynamic approximation. And there are many systems in which two key features happen, both at the theoretical and then experimental level. Well, one is that quasi-particles, so the excitations over the fluid, don't see the laboratory background space, and space-time, but some effective geometry defined by the variables that characterize the fluid, density and velocity. And in some more restricted examples, the more limited examples, the aerodynamics that describes the motion of the fluid can even approximate at least some features of the gravitational dynamics for the effective metric defined in terms of the metric of the velocity and density of the fluid. And the examples range from Bose-Einstein condensates to fermionic helium and so on. And you will hear about this and related issues in Sindoni's talk today. Another example of emergent gravity is that of matrix models. Start from a theory that has nothing to do with gravity a priori. Just your fundamental variables are Hermitian matrices, n by n. You define a certain action for them that is written there. You define the partition function, and you expand it in Feynman diagrams. From the choice of action follows the choice of amplitude. And by the way the action is constructed follows also that the Feynman graphs are dual to two-dimensional triangulations. That means that you're defining your quantum gravity theory as a sum over two-dimensional triangulations of all topologies. And one can show that in the suitable limit called double scaling, the partition function becomes equivalent to that of a gravity theory in two dimensions, defined as a sum over 2D surfaces. Again, this is a concrete example in which the idea of discrete geometry merges with the idea of an emergent geometry, because as I said, the fundamental theory has nothing to do with gravity to start with. Okay, I'll give you one more example in, 5 minutes. Okay, so group field theory is can be interpreted as a quantum field theory of discrete constituents of space, and therefore space-time. And you can describe them diagrammatically or pictorially, either as basic simplices or graphs labeled by what at this stage you can only call pre-geometric data. And the field, which is the basic variable of these models, is in general a complex field defined over a group manifold, given by a tensor, direct product of copies of the Lorentz group. So your variables, which are the arguments of the field, are group elements. But you can also expand in modes, the analog of momentum space, and you define your field as a function of group representations. And that's there's a picture for the three-dimensional example. So you have a field that can be described either as a function of group elements or as a function of group representations. And pictorially, you can see it as a triangle with the edges labeled by this type of variables, or dually by a vertex of a graph, of a trivalent vertex of a graph, again with the edges labeled by these variables. And the duality is depicted there. Okay. You define an action that is in many ways very similar to that of matrix models. Here, I mean, I'm being very implicit, but the basic point about the action is that the vertex as the combinatorics of the matching of the gluing of triangles in this example in a tetrahedron, so in three-dimensional simplex. So the vertex in this example has four fields, and the three arguments of each field are identified in the different fields of the vertex pairwise with the same combinatorics of the gluing of the four triangles over the tetrahedron to form it by gluing along edges. And the kinetic term describes the gluing of different tetrahedra in this three-dimensional example, in general different d-dimensional simplices, along the common triangle. So in this sense, it's a generalization of matrix models. And there is a more complicated combinatorics so that you can describe higher dimensional simplicial complexes. And there are, in addition to the more complicated combinatorics, you have group theoretic data that turn what was a quantum mechanical system matrix model into a field theory. So the quantum theory, as in matrix models, is defined by the Feynman expansion in graphs of the partition function. And the, by construction, the Feynman diagrams are topologically dual to d-dimensional pseudo-manifolds in general. In general, are simplicial complexes, not necessarily simplicial manifolds. And they are of arbitrary topology, simply because you construct them just out of gluing simplices together with no a priori restriction on how to glue them to define some specific topology. The Feynman amplitudes can be written in both configuration and momentum space. And what is interesting and has generated lots of activity in this field, in this area, is that in momentum space, so when you define the field as a function of representations of the group, and therefore the amplitudes are functions of these representations, the Feynman amplitude associated to each of these graphs is a spin form model. So you make a direct link with loop quantum gravity ideas and structures. At the same time, you can understand the Feynman diagram, the Feynman amplitude, sorry, associated to each simplicial complex as a sort of a discrete path integral defined on that particular discretization of a continuum space-time. So you see emerging of structures and insights from different approaches. And so this is an example, this is why I wanted to show it to you, of how the ideas from different approaches and different perspectives on the problem of quantum gravity are shown not to be incompatible. I don't have time for an example, I guess. I have 10 minutes of questions. Fine, we have many models of quantum gravity. Each researcher has its own favorite one, and they fight with blood and tears to show that they are correct and all the others are wrong. That's fine, I guess, it's part of the game. But the big open issue is take your favorite model, then show me that you can reproduce general relativity in the appropriate scale in some approximation that you can justify on physical grounds. And in particular, if your model has, in the end, basically all of these quantum gravity models, does not describe the Planck scale physics in terms of a continuum geometry, a continuum space-time, and so on, show me how you recover the notion of a continuum space-time and of a continuum geometry in some approximation. And let me note that there are many limits or approximations involved, which should not be confused with each other. And they are, of course, very much intertwined, but they're different conceptually and practically. There's the semi-classical approximation. GR is a classical theory. There is the continuum approximation if you are in some discrete or pre-geometric setting. And there is a large-scale approximation. They're not the same. Of course, the exact nature of the problem and how it manifests itself varies a lot and depends on the details of the different approaches. So I'm not going to give any overview of what the problem is. But I noticed that the problem is conceptual, first of all, because as I said, I mean, if you go from a theory with no space-time, defined or no space-time, well, it's a huge conceptual step to describe the origin of space-time structures. So what are the degrees of freedom that become space-time degrees of freedom somehow? What is the organization principle by which this fundamental non-geometric and non-space-time degrees of freedom become space-time, described by space-time? What are the observables that you have to use to guide these approximations? There's a huge gap in scales. So we are really being very bold here. I mean, let me note that from the scale of a quark to the Planck scale, there's basically the same order of magnitude as from the human scale to the quark scale. And there's lots of stuff between a human and a quark, right? And of course, I mean, I was not even going to mention them. There are huge, purely technical, mathematical difficulties, and you will hear about some of them in the more technical talks. Anyway, there are many ideas and different avenues that have been followed, that are being followed in order to go back to geometry and space-time from the Planck scale. And there are many results, so let me just briefly mention some of the avenues and some of the ideas being tried. So one area that has received lots of attention and has produced many results is loop quantum cosmology. So you take the basic setting of loop quantum gravity, and you drastically reduce the degrees of freedom using a symmetry reduction. Basically, what is done in even in general relativity when you want to describe cosmology. So this way, you have drastically simplified the theory, and you can actually do stuff. I mean, you can actually follow the evolution of the few degrees of freedom that are left for describing space-time from the quantum regime to the classical regime. And they're very intriguing results. There are indications that singularities may be completely avoided, just absent in a proper treatment of quantum geometry. You can recover a semi-classical limit from the quantum description very nicely, and you get an effective modified classical dynamics that differs from GR in some key aspects. So in loop quantum cosmology, we basically realize the dream of a quantum gravity theory, except that it's in a very simplified context. There are many results in loop quantum gravity and spin-form models concerning coherent states approximating, in a suitable sense, classical geometries. And there are calculations of quantum gravity endpoint functions in this context. So first of all, the key achievement was a proposal for how to define these endpoint functions in a quantum gravity context. That means in a background-independent context. And they're based on coherent states for quantum geometry. And then there have been several computations of quantum gravity correlations between different points, or the endpoint functions, at the simplicial level in some lowest order approximation that I'm not going to specify. There is a proposal at this stage, no more than a proposal, for the use of for the development and the use of group field theory in a statistical setting, and for the development of a group field theory hydrodynamics to describe very large ensembles, very complicated spin network states that should approximate a continuum, and also taking in the ideas and insights from some condensed matter and analog gravity models. And these in particular are concrete models of the emergence of geometry and of effective space-time from something that, that doesn't know about geometry. That's why we find them interesting. Some of us find them interesting. Also, they provide very nice examples, and again, very concrete, which in quantum gravity is a big achievement, examples of possible phenomenological consequences of this emergence of space-time and geometry from something that is not about space-time and geometry. a very wide area research to which I don't, well, I'm not really treating it appropriately for how important it is that of non-commutative geometry, non-commutative models of quantum gravity. So first of all, non-commutative geometry is a very general framework for what could be quantum geometry, a priori unrelated to other approaches to quantum gravity. But also you can interpret it as a general framework for an effective quantum gravity kinematics, so a regime of quantum gravity in which you neglect strong gravitational effects, but still you retain some quantum features of the fundamental quantum gravity theory. Again, two things, remember, do not necessarily have to go together. And there are also some examples of how an effective non-commutative quantum field theory for matter fields can emerge from other models of quantum gravity, like spin forms or group field theory. All this to say that there are many, as I said, many paths being followed, many ideas. And to close with some optimism, I mean, we even have a reasonable hope that we may be close to phenomenology, so not only to some effective description, but to real phenomenology. Until a few years ago, this seemed like a dream or a statement of a fool. But now we have seen that there are some scenarios involving, for example, either a deformation or a violation of fundamental symmetries, in particular, much studied concerns the issue of Lorentz invariants and Poincaré invariants, to be maybe more precise. And also scenarios in which you try to derive consequences of the existence of a minimal length, which seems to be either an assumption or a prediction of several quantum gravity models. And the point is that the experiments can really maybe already there waiting for us. Not to mention the effects, that the observations that I mentioned at the beginning about the very large scale problems we have with the description of gravity in cosmology. Okay, so I conclude. Okay, to let's face it, quantum gravity is still an open problem. I apologize for that. However, I hope you gather from this very introductory and very sketchy talk that we are really dealing with something truly fundamental, and the challenges come with this. We cannot expect the true nature of space and time to be a mythic piece, right? And we are dealing really with big questions about space, time, the universe, and so on, but with important physical consequences. Otherwise, we'll leave it to philosophers, probably, as we've done for lots of time. We're not yet there, but really, here you should be in your go on and read the literature. We are progressing fast, I would say, especially in the last 20 years. And we're really learning a lot in many different directions. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Quota of time for questions. 5 to 10 minutes. So if you have any.
Sure.
You have time?
I have two questions. First of all, for the matrix model, you stopped at quarter and the third. Is there a specific reason for that, or you can just keep expanding the action there in higher and higher power?
Well,
in the matrix model.
Oh, in the matrix model, no. There was no specific action. We just started with the simplicity of exposition. So you can say, as you probably know.
Just the matrix.
Yeah.
My second question has to do with the LHC. So. Is anything that the LHC discovered
particle physics talk?
No, I'm a particle physicist.
Ah, okay.
No, I'm giving a great example. So, for example, if the LHC does not discover or discover supersymmetry, that applies a lot to people's interest in superspin spectrum. In terms of some of these approaches, does it have any relevance or not?
Okay, so the situation in many of these approaches, as far as I understand, is the following. Well, let's say at least in loop quantum gravity and spin foam models, we know better. Some additional difficulties in dynamical triangulation, in group field theories, and I'm really not sure about dynamical triangulations of other approaches. Supersymmetry is a possibility with, you know, if you're interested with some work, you can incorporate it into the models. And actually, our chair here has done some work in the context of spin foam models. And there's no, up to now, we have not seen any obstacle, either mathematical or conceptual, for the incorporation of supersymmetry. But at the same time, none of these approaches, the one that I know a bit more about, seems to require it. That's the situation.
So just to follow up, can you be more specific on what phenomenological questions you have in mind?
So in the context, for example, of violations or deformations of the Lorentz symmetry, I mean, that comes with the modified dispersion relations and and modified thresholds for particle physics reactions. So the some examples that have been investigated, but I mean, I guess there are more people more expert than I am on that for the details, are, well, in gamma ray burst, for example, that travel cosmological distances, and somehow they are using, you know, the large distances and amplification of the small Planck scale effects. So the modified dispersion relations will cause, for example, a different time of arrival than the one you would expect from ordinary dispersion relations. Another example is with cosmic rays. And maybe with some more thinking, I can come up with other examples. Is that the other one?
Isn't it fair to say that unless you actually implement particles into the theory, you won't be able to test any of these? Because, of course, everything that you observe are particles.
Can you implement what?
Implement particles, matter.
You mean incorporate, like
copy?
Yeah,
yes. Yeah? So I mean, everything we observe is matter, like photons or other things. So I guess none of these can be tested unless somebody tells us how to put matter particles into the...
Yes, for the simple reason, well, okay. For testing, you're right, of course. We only observe particles and matter, so we need to incorporate matter. And we know how to incorporate, with some questions open, still open, how to incorporate matter fields in loop quantum gravity, spin foam models, in many of these approaches. Again, maybe not in all of them. That is true. But as I said, there is a question that is prior to that. I mean, it's not obvious that you should incorporate matter in these models before you know that these models can generate some continuum space-time structure. So there are different points of view of this. I mean, maybe that this space-time continuum emerges only if you have incorporated some matter degrees of freedom. On the other hand, the way we understand matter is in terms of fields moving and particles moving on a given continuum. So it's not obvious what you want to incorporate in this pre-geometric and pre-continuum structures. Yeah. So there is a kind of a tension and lots of work. So,
for example, what you mentioned about this gamma ray burst and the time of arrival.
No, for that, what usually one does is to construct effective models. So you don't test directly these theories. Also for the Genkel scales that I mentioned at some point. What you do is to try to identify some key features or some key predictions of these approaches, and then to incorporate this prediction, like, for example, the existence of a minimal length or, as I said, or some deformation of the Lorentz symmetry in some effective model that where you lose contact with the fundamental degrees of freedom, and you try to test the properties of these effective models. Is not really, at this stage, is not obviously a test of the fundamental description.
Yeah, so those approaches of discretized geometry, this is just my ignorance of it. Is that usually done in three-dimensional space or infinite dimension?
It depends on the approach, how many results we have in different dimensions, but this is done in any dimension.
Because my main curiosity is how this Lorentz signature comes out of the picture.
Well, okay. I can give you an example in the group theory setting, for example. that the choice of signature comes in the choice of the group manager you define your field of. If you choose the Lorentz group with the appropriate signature, like the four-dimensional Lorentz group, SO3-1, then the amplitudes become dependent on the Lorentz group representations, which come in discrete and continuous series. And you can identify this difference. You can match this difference between continuous and discrete representations into space-like geometric variables and time-like geometric variables. So that the question really depends, I mean, the answer to the question really depends a lot on the approach.
But in that approach depends on the group you choose.
But wait, I mean, when you talk about, sorry, before I answer your second, your follow-up, I mean, when you say three and four dimensions, here I'm answering, you know, according to three space-time dimensions and four space-time dimensions.
Three space dimension or three.
Okay, but then is the difference between a canonical approach and some covariant approach. And again, that depends on what approach you're following.
So in the example you gave, it depends on the group you choose. If you,
in the group theory, yeah. Setting, yes.
You choose that or four, then you know.
You are trying to describe a Riemannian graph.
Are there any predictions from this loop? As far as the models for gravitational waves? First of all, is inflation, for example, do you need to use that?
So, not that I know, but we have the expert here.
Okay, not yet.
No.
So, people are still working on them, but there are no trustable predictions so far.
You need to embed inflation into these models? Or is
yeah.
The model
you have to consider an inflationary scenario with these models, and then you can study the effect of group quantization on the perturbations. So these things are still in progress.
So actually, I can make a comment. So there are some alternatives to inflation that people accordingly have suggested that have, might have a specific predictions for gravitational waves, but do you know that, sir? Is there a specific prediction? Yes,
yeah. Which alternative are you thinking of?
The one that you had with Carlo and Paul.
With Carlo and our paper with Carlo and Zhao. No, we did not thoroughly study. We were very happy to get a near scale invariant spectrum of perturbations. And we looked at gravitational waves. We had the impression that they would be small, but we did not put it into the paper because we did not reach a firm conclusion. There's maybe something coming.
Are there any more questions? All right, in that case, we'll take a break and we'll be back at another.